And that is to acknowledge the presence of Carla Greer, because Carla Levine, sorry. So Carla could very easily give this whole class in her sleep, as some of you know. She has a lot of experience teaching and educating about English literature. So I asked her to please chime in when she has something to correct that I'm going to say that's not on the mark. I'm not a student of English literature. I'm not a professor of English literature. I'm just a curious person, and I'm interested in the humanities. One of my favorite stories of all time is that I got into a taxi cab in Midtown Manhattan on 34th Street and Lexington with a young woman for our first date. And this woman looks at me and she says, "So, what are you studying?" So I said, "Well, you know, I'm in Smicha, and when I was in college, I studied the humanities. I majored in history. I was interested in English." I said, "So what are you interested in?" She's like, "Well, right now I'm taking biochem and physics and four other science courses that I couldn't even spell, you know." So she told me afterwards, she said, she thought it was over. She thought there was no way that this shidduch was going to go anyway. But now, five children later, it works out very well, because she does all the math science homework and I do all the literature, English, and the paper writing homework. So anyway, I'm interested in this, and the reason why we're discussing this tonight is because as Jewish people, we are constantly thinking, we're constantly analyzing that which goes on around us. We're exploring, we're searchers, we ask questions. You know, the basic building block of Jewish education, the Seder, it's all about asking questions. So many of us grow up in a world where we are exposed to and interested in the great works of literature that have been passed down to us over a long period of time. So I find that when you look at things through Jewish glasses, you can gain a lot of insight and information. You can synthesize, you can integrate the world that you're living in on the outside and the spiritual world that you're building on the inside. So this comes up in certain, sometimes in practical ways. I want to mention tonight three different plays by Shakespeare. This volume is the complete works of William Shakespeare. We're only going to highlight three of them. But there are so many ways to think about, as a Jewish person, as a thinking, religious, spiritual being, to think about the lessons that you can take away from the world around us, and especially from someone as insightful as William Shakespeare. So, you know, imagine, for example, a couple of years ago, my wife and I, we were invited to Glasgow, Scotland, to share Torah there. I had been there once before teaching, and so we were invited back as a couple. So we went and we stopped in London on the way there. So we happened to be in London at the time that the Shakespeare Theatre was putting on a production of As You Like It, which is a terrific and wonderful play. So we went, and after the first intermission, we're walking down into the lobby, and I said to Mechama, I'm like, this would make a terrific shiur, I have to tell you. So she's always like, why does it always have to come back to that? But the answer is, it really does always come back to that. Even if you don't engage as your vocation in teaching Torah and studying, but the idea of looking at things through a Jewish lens is very important. Now that notwithstanding, I would say it is important to think about how we calibrate our Jewish learning, our Jewish reading. You know, this is a great book. It's a huge book. It's a great book. If I threw it at you, Mrs. Leonard, it would hurt, you know? It would. It's huge. But I would say it's important to keep in mind that while this is an important book, how we prioritize it in our library is also an important question. When I go to people's homes, one of the things that I do when I'm sitting in their living room is I always glance at their library. Because a person's library says a lot about them. Right? It says a lot about their interests and what kind of, you know, curiosities they have. So if you think about what your library looks like, and even if you don't have a library, if you were to build a library, what would be the book that's in the center of that library? And each of us need to think about that. It's a great question. Yeah, what were we going to say, Jim? The Torah. Right? If you were to ask, this is a great question to have like as an icebreaker, if you did like a, you know, a company event, great icebreaker. What's your favorite book, or what book goes in the center of your library? So we have a book of life. And that book really goes in the center of our library, both physically, but also on your mattering map, so to speak, from a psychological standpoint. It's that book, it's the book of life that sustained us for generations. If you know, you think about how we as a people have been exiled over centuries and millennia, and yet what connected us was not necessarily a shared land or a shared language, but it was a shared volume. It was a volume of scholarship that sometimes wasn't even passed down in paper or parchment. It was passed down in a reading from teacher to student in an oral tradition. We call that the Book of Life. That is the Torah. Now, the Torah has a written component, it has an oral component, but it's a guidebook for life as well. So when you think about where we're going to look for lessons, you can find a lot of great lessons in Shakespeare. But like, imagine, I would say like this. In the old days, when we used to buy appliances or any things, they used to come with instruction manuals. You remember those days?
Yeah.
Right? They used to come with instruction manuals. So imagine you had somebody who was purchasing a brand new, in the old days, TVs came with manuals. An old TV, and they wanted to get this TV to work. So you have two people who are interested in reading about this TV. You have the person who's actually wants the TV to function, and then you have the person who's kind of like the bystander who's looking at the specs of the TV. Both of them could tell you about that TV, right? The first person could tell you, okay, this is where I need to mount it on the wall, or I need it. In those days, you didn't mount anything on the wall. You would put it on a shelf, and this is the plug that needs to go in this place. Remember, they used to have colored wires where you had to put them in one into the other? And the other person could tell you, well, this is how tall it is, and this is how wide it is, because they're reading the outside of the box. You know, the Torah, the gift that Hashem, that God gave us, is that He didn't just give us the specs on the box. That's science, right? Science is the specs on the box. Literature, you learn a lot about human nature, and we'll talk about this in a minute, by reading the specs on the box. But you don't necessarily get to know the soul of the entity. You don't really know how it works, how to get the TV to operate. Well, I'll give you a different analogy. Another analogy to try to understand and appreciate that, yes, there is value in what we're going to study tonight in the works of Shakespeare, but it's not the core of our life. Imagine, let's say, we have a terrific young woman who is now newly married, was the office manager of our kolo. So if you were to ask her, how would she get to know her future husband? So there are two ways that she could get to know her future husband. The first way, before they go out, option A, is to call his pediatrician or his internist. I don't know who that is. That's HIPAA, so I'm not going to ask. But if you call the pediatrician, they'll tell you exactly how tall he is, how heavy he is, and they'll be honest. They won't lie. They'll tell you what color his eyes are. They'll tell you what blood type he is. They'll tell you a lot of information if you call the pediatrician. So that's one way to get to know somebody. But that's not a good approach. If you want to set up shop with someone to be a life partner, you need to take them on a date. You need to talk to them. You need to engage with them. So the study of Torah, the primary book that's on our shelf, that's like going on a date. That's like having a conversation with God. That's the most intimate experience. But there's also another way to get to know God. It's to call the pediatrician, so to speak. It's to get to know God through the world that He gave us. These are both paths. But it's understanding the priorities and appreciating them. So it's not in a vacuum. It's not all about Shakespeare. It's not all about Torah. It's about finding the proper balance and the synthesis. So one might say, wait a second, okay, I can see why there's value in studying Torah. That's the guidebook of our life. That is our spiritual reservoir. And I can see why there's value in certain secular disciplines which integrate with the Torah learning. For example, you want to build a sukkah. This could be potentially a great place to build a sukkah, I suspect. Could, right? Well, figuring out how to build a sukkah here might require a discipline called mathematics or physics, right? Because you have to know how tall are these beams and how strong are they and what material are they made out of. So I could see how, and in some places, in some communities, you will find that they place a great emphasis on studying Torah and also studying the hard sciences, math and science. These are disciplines that clearly interact with Torah study. If you want to know how to build a mikveh, just theoretically. Theoretically, if you're working on building a mikveh.
Okay.
Well, you need to have some background in physics and math and engineering to be able to pour the concrete for the boros. You have to know how to build a mikveh that there shouldn't be cracks, and that when the ground settles, you don't want to wake up one day and see that there's a leak. So all of those require important secular disciplines. They require great expertise. So why would we take any time then and study, like when I went to college and I was the major in history and humanities, why would I waste my time with such silly works like Shakespeare? What do you learn from that? How does that integrate into a religious life? So this question was addressed in a terrific essay, not that he needs my approbation, one of the greatest rabbinic authorities, giants of Torah, of the past generation. His name is Rabbi Dr. Alan Lichtenstein. Rabbi Lichtenstein was the son-in-law and a chief student of Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik. He was a Talmudic giant, also a PhD from Harvard in English literature. He was an expert in Milton and all other names that I never heard of. Rabbi Lichtenstein has an essay, which you have on the first page of your packet, which is called The End of Learning. And obviously, as he describes, the purpose of this essay is not to explore what it means, the termination of learning, the end of learning, rather the telos of learning. The telos of learning, the purpose. So here we are, thinking about the purpose of learning, the purpose of appreciating God's handiwork. Well, part of studying Torah is to get to know God, like we said, kind of going on a date, the study of Torah. But God gave every human being, every creature, a soul. Every creature in the world is B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God. Says Rav Lichtenstein, what do you learn from the humanities? He says, it's a window into the human spirit. That's what we understand. When you study literature, I'm not talking about everything that's ever been written. I'm talking about great works of literature. You understand as he writes, take a look. On the left-hand column, Leaves of Faith, it's his collected essays. Is it conceivable then that anyone would consider contemplation of God's handiwork as adequate while omitting study of its fullest manifestation? Look at the bottom where they put the arrow. But what about man do we primarily seek to know? The psychologist, the cell structure, the geneticist, recombinant DNA, the behaviorist, Pavlovian responses. But the committed Jew, what do we want to know about humanity? I'm on the bottom of page one on the left-hand side. Tselem Elohim. The study of man's spirit. Next column, the top, where the arrow is. The study of man as spirit is, however, what the humanities are all about. In essence, they deal with man qua individual and in society, with the record and recreation of his habitat and activity, with speculation about himself, his context, and his interaction. Says Rav Lichtenstein, this book is a window into the human spirit. It tells us about the author, it tells us about the people, the times, and what they're all about. So as we go through life as religious people, thinking about Torah and how it relates to the Tselem Elohim, to the humanity in all of us, we use the humanities, especially literature, but also history, from a little bit of a different lens, but history very much so, in terms of understanding humanity and what it means to be human, what the human spirit is all about. So as my first example tonight, I'll reflect on a great piece here. It's one of the first plays in this collection of Shakespeare, and it's called King Lear. The reason why I reflect on King Lear first, so the most, anybody here study King Lear? Any hands? Yes? Okay. So what is the most common, prominent theme that you would find in King Lear? What would you say? Kibbutz Ava'im. Great. So Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik, has a very important essay in one of his posthumously published volumes on Kibbutz Ava'im, and he talks about the external manifestation of Kibbutz Ava'im, how we treat our parents, but also the internal, how we feel, what our relationship was like with our parents. But there's another aspect which I think gives you insight. The end of the play, which is extremely tragic, basically everybody dies. That's how it goes. Everybody dies. But why do they die? They die because of a very complicated and entangled web of treachery. One person backstabbing somebody else, who backstabs the next person, who backstabs the next person. And what you end up is with a series of portraits of people whose lives have gone wrong and end in murder and suicide because of bad choices that they've made. There's a verse in Koheles, the book that we read. It's a complicated book. It's not a simple book, but we read it every time in Sukkot. We read this Koheles, this book about the philosophy of the world. And in Perek Gimel, in chapter 3, it says, Elohim bara es ha'adam yashar. God created the world and humanity, created man straight. Each one of us has a natural and inborn moral compass. Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, the first founding chief rabbi of the settlement of Israel, develops this idea that deep down each one of us has a proper moral compass. But then the pasuk concludes, the verse concludes, V'heim bikshu cheshbonos rabim. People, they sought after, they pursued many cheshbonot, calculations. In Yiddish, there's a Yiddish expression, cheshbonos, a lot of, thoughts back and manipulation. The story of King Lear is a story of manipulation, right? There's three daughters. Two of them say, oh, we love you, we love you. The father's going to give them away the inheritance. The third daughter says, what can I say? Can't say anything. She gets banished. They come chasing the next one and the next one. And each one is backstabbing the next. This is a portrait. You look at this and you say, wait a second, I can learn from this story. I can realize the difference between a simple life, a life of yashar, of yashrus, of upright, straight talk, versus a life of convoluted backstabbing. You read this poem, you read this play, and you almost wonder, how do the people make these decisions? Then you stay back. You know what? I know a lot of people who may fall into that same trap. I know myself. I look in the mirror. How often do I fall into that trap? The Vilna Gaon, the great genius of Vilna in the end of the 18th century, one of the greatest rabbinic figures, he says, we like to think about the Torah as being binary, so to speak. You can bifurcate it into two categories. Bein Adam LaMakom, which means between us and God, and Bein Adam LaChaveiro, which means between man and man. Says the Vilna Gaon, there are actually three colors in this Neapolitan religion. There's between man and God, there's between man and man, and there's between man and himself. His character development. The Gemara tells us that a person wants to be pious. He wants to be a super Jew. The first opinion is, Yekayim milei debrachos. Fulfill your obligations of blessings. Says the Vilna Gaon, blessings, you're thanking God. It's you and God. The second opinion in the Gemara, I'm out a little out of order, is, be careful about interpersonal damages. Don't run over your friend's baseball bat in the street. Don't damage. Watch out for interpersonal. That's Bein Adam LaChaveiro. But then the Gemara says, Yekayim Mili de Avos. Fulfill the words of Pirkei Avos, ethics of the fathers. Because it's ethical development, moral development. It's not just two, it's three. And that's something only you know on the inside. And then it becomes manifest in how you lead your life. You see a corrupt life. You see people who make too many cheshbonos. You see the end of King Lear. How does it end up? It's a giant mess. Because they moved away from character development, from Midos Bein Adam La'atzmo, like the Vilna Gaon says, and it became a world of treachery. Anything to add for King Lear, Carla?
Was written to transmute his pain, at least into something artistic, but he could never answer the question. And so I would ask my students, okay, let's look at some sparring and let's come up with an answer. But that is why this work is so painful, because of the fact that that question goes unanswered. One wonderful thing about Torah is that we can find answers to that question about our own lives. You know, why do we suffer, and is there a purpose, and is Hashem there? Other thing that we talked about was the very beginning of the work. You see, what starts the whole thing in motion is the narcissism of King Lear and his need for narcissistic gratification and to have all of this love be barraged upon him, because he does not have an authentic sense of self that only really comes through, again, a connection with God. And without that, when somebody has all this spiritual emptiness, he is going to grasp at, you know, fatuous and specious expressions of love. And so sometimes I bring in, like, Abraham Tversky's works on self-esteem, yeah. And we just talk about, where does real self-esteem come from? And again, it's going to come often from being a life committed to Torah and having and knowing that God feels my purpose.
Comes from within, absolutely. There's a beautiful line, just to pick up on that last one before we move on, is there was a great Hasidic master who lived in the end of the 19th century. End of the 19th century. He died at the beginning of the 20th century. His name was Reb Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin. Reb Tzadok HaKohen Rabinowitz. You know what he says? He says that Kashem shall Adam tzarech lahamin b'Hashem Yisbarach. Just like a person needs to believe in God, kach tzarech ha'adam lahamin ba'atzmo. So too a person has to believe in themselves. And those two are interconnected. Because when we get up in the morning and we say, moda ani lefanecha, God, thank you very much because you have given back my soul. Bechemlo rabo emunasecha. You have faith in me to have a good day. Okay, we're going to move on to The Merchant of Venice. So here is probably the most well-known. It's not clear if Shakespeare ever met a Jew in his life, because at that time, Jews had been expelled from England, they had been expelled from many different places. Jews were expelled from England. I don't know if he ever met someone. But here we have The Merchant of Venice, the most famous interaction between Antonio, the Merchant of Venice, and his friend Shylock, the rich Jew, who's, of course, the moneylender. Now, the reason that Jews had been involved in moneylending in the Middle Ages is primarily because they were excluded from other professions. So they were either in the shmata business or some other, you know, bartering, stuff like that. So the real question, there is actually a great rabbinic luminary. His name is, he passed away maybe about 30 years ago. His name is Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, a prolific author, who wrote a rabbinic essay on the Merchant of Venice, according to the halacha. And the question is the argument of a pound of flesh for the money that's due, is that enforceable in Jewish law? Forget the ethical considerations. Is such an argument, could somebody make that claim to say, look, you know, I'll lend you $1 million if you don't pay a piece of your arm? Dr. Sales says no. Why not?
Because you harm yourself. You're not allowed to harm yourself.
Why not?
Because the other goyim used to harm themselves.
Okay, that's one. Lo yisutu saratis. But you're already on the track. Take a look on the next page. One second. Yes? Turn the page well. Yes?
We're made in the image of Hashem.
Yes? We are made in the image of Hashem, and therefore you can't harm yourself, and it's even more than this. This is the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. This is the compendium of the Shulchan Aruch authored by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe of Shneur Zalman of Liadi in the Hebrew. So he mentions what Dr. Sales just says here in Hilchos Nizkim Guf in Issues of Damages. I'm reading in the Hebrew. I'll translate it to where I put the arrow. Asur lahakos eschavero. You may not hurt someone. You may not hit someone else. Afilu nosin lo rishus, even if he gives you permission, lahakosa. Why? In the underline, ke'ein la'adam rishus al gufo klal. I am not the owner of my physical body, so I can't give it away. Why not? Why am I not the owner of my body? Because the Almighty is the owner of my person. I'm just a custodian. I have to take care of it. And therefore, there is a comment on the Rambam, authored by Rab David Ibn Zimmer from the 16th century from Egypt, who explains this principle that you're not the owner of your body, and therefore you can't take your own life and you can't give it away. And even if you were to say, punch me in the nose, you would still have to pay me, even if I said, you know, no problem, because you don't have that authority. The whole notion for a Jewish person of who they are is very much wrapped up in this idea. You know, imagine, someone once said a great mashal, imagine if, God forbid, somebody had a limb that had to be transplanted from one person to a different person. Well, who are you? Well, are you, if you're the recipient of the limb, are you the same person or are you a different person? You gave it away. Are you the same person or are you somebody else? The answer is, obviously, you're the same person. You just have a different... Well, you could take that ad infinitum and just realize that what makes me, me, is my soul. It's my spirit. You know, there's the thing, and you'll excuse my language, but it is the absolute stupidest thing that people tell kids. It is. They tell them, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never harm me. We all know that it is exactly the opposite. People have said things to us in our lifetime, and they hurt a lot more. They hurt a lot deeper than if somebody were just to break my bone and then I can go to the orthopedist, they'll help me fix it. Because names, that hurts your neshama. That hurts your personality, your whole fabric of your experiences, your whole life. Names really hurt a lot worse than broken bones. People who get into disagreements, they hurt a lot deeper. Never tell your kids that names hurt a lot more. Because that hurts your neshama. So my goof, my body, wait a second, when I moved to Chicago, I had dark hair. Now, not so much. Doesn't change who I am. I mean, I still have, but not so much. But just because your external changes doesn't mean you're not the same person. You are your neshama. And therefore, you're just a custodian on your body. And as a custodian, you have responsibilities and you can't just give it away. So the whole idea of the Merchant of Venice is predicated on a mistake. It's not that we have the right to give it away. All right, the last comment I'll make, and with this we're going to conclude, is on page 3. And this was my favorite line from As You Like It. Here they are in the forest. You have Orlando, who is the son of Sir Roland, and you have Adam the servant. And Orlando is on the run, and he's being chased away, and yet, who's still hanging out with him? Who's still following him around? Adam, the trusty servant. And Adam is much older than Orlando. So says Orlando, I love this line, it's an amazing line. Oh, good old man, how well then thee appears the constant service of the antique world, when service sweat for duty, not for meed. Thou art not for the fashion of these times, where none will sweat but for promotion, and having that do, choke up their service up even with the having. By the way, mead is, anybody know what mead is? Beer, honey beer. Honey beer or date beer. What is Orlando saying to Adam? He's saying something, he's saying Yiddish, Gewaldig! He says, look at you, old man. Why are you following me around? I have nothing to offer you. I'm on the lam. We're in the forest somewhere. But the reason you're following me is for the sake of service. Because in the old days, people did their job just for the sake of doing their job, because that was their mission in life. Not because they were looking for a promotion, not because they were waiting for somebody to give them a tip or a beer or something on the side. You're doing it because that's the right thing to do. Now, we're not going to engage now in a discussion about the situation of service in Elizabethan and Victorian England, and what is that show called? They just finished their 7th season. My wife is watching it. Yeah. Downton Abbey and the people living in the basement. We're not going to get into that. Let's just leave the servants as servants for the moment. But the idea that this old man Adam is following around Orlando in the forest, because that's what he's meant to do, for no ulterior purpose. How noble is that? How beautiful is that? That's what the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos on the top line, Reb Meir Omer, Kol Ha'osek B'Torah L'Shema Zocha L'Dvarim Harbei. A person who engages in Torah study just L'Shema, just for the sake of it. just because it's meaningful, just because we understand that's where we belong. Not because we're going to get paid, not because we're going to get honored by the synagogue, not because anybody's watching us. We just do it because that's our passion in life. We go back to where we started. What's the main book on our bookshelf? A person who engages in it because that's where they want to be, Zocha L'Dvarim Harbi, it's incredible. That's real service of Hashem. That's the most noble, that's the highest level. Service just for the sake of service. And this is a concept in Jewish tradition called Torah Lishma. Studying Torah just for the sake of Torah study. I'll close with one anecdote. There was a great rabbinic luminary. His name is Rabbi Lazer Shach. He died not too long ago. So at one point he had a certain ill health. He had a certain health issue that the doctor said that he needed a measure of rest. So his wife sent him to bed early. She woke up 1 o'clock in the morning to use the restroom. She saw he wasn't in bed. He was downstairs learning. Because he was so excited. He was so engaged in his Torah study. It meant so much to him. So the next night she decided, you know what? He's very involved in learning. He doesn't know where the circuit breaker is. She'll keep the circuit breaker switched off. She'll shut the electricity off. Because this way he won't be able to learn. So he'll actually sleep through the night. She wakes up 1 o'clock in the morning. The next night she sees him downstairs again. He found a yard site candle. Because to him, it was service for the sake of service. It was learning because he just loved learning. I was listening to the radio a couple of weeks ago, and they had an interesting, not too long ago, they had an interesting debate, which we here, we're not going to debate this question, but theoretically, they'll debate this question. Who is greater? Who's greater? LeBron James or Michael Jordan? A Shiloh. For us, it's not a Shiloh. So the guy on NPR, who is an ESPN columnist, and I'll leave you with this, he had an unbelievable quote. Now, he's saying this quote about this question, but the quote is really about Torah. He says, the truth is, we on ESPN, this is how we make a living, this is what we talk about all day, he says, we're never going to answer the question. He says, because when you love the argument so much, you never want it to end. You ever open up a page of Gemara and you ask yourself, so why the rabbis keep arguing? Just cut out 3 pages of arguments and just get to the answer. The answer is, because when you love the argument so much, you never want it to end. It's not about the bottom line. It's when you are engaged in that book on our shelf, in the Torah HaKadosh, in the Holy Torah, you just don't want the argument to end. And that's what really life is all about. It's finding that service. That's what Orlando says, we should each try to be like Adam, the old servant, to find ways to serve just, to serve Hashem just for the sake of service, for that incredible nobility. I think it's unbelievably inspiring. So I thank you all for coming, for listening.